Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop.
Pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 79 of the Culture Pop Podcast. Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske. And Sue, our guest today, I'm really excited about. One of the best working actors in Hollywood. He has appeared in films like Changeling, The Adjustment Bureau, Now You See Me, Man of Steel. From television, you know him as Doug Stamper on the iconic series House of Cards. And now he is starring in the new Showtime miniseries, The Comey Rule, premiering this Sunday night again on Showtime. Michael Kelly is here. Michael, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, man. That was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it.
So we both have watched The Comey Rule over this weekend, and it is fantastic. Written and directed by my friend Billy Ray. The film is based on James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty. How did the project originally come to you?
It's funny, actually. Billy Ray, who I had worked with before on Secret in Their Eyes with Julia Roberts.
Right.
And so we had a relationship, and we follow each other on social media. And he had posted that he had this project coming up. And when he announced it, I was like, sounds good. Who am I playing? Just totally kidding. And then I got the call from my team a while. Well, actually, Billy Ray reached out first and said, hey, you're going to be getting a call. I had no idea it was for Andrew McCabe, and I was just over the moon when I got the offer to play the role.
You look so much like him.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Did you ever meet him?
I did. I really wanted to get him. And so when Billy and I were talking, he said he would make the introduction, and he introduced the two of us via email. And we emailed a couple times, and then we started texting. And then one day he just texted me out of the blue and was like, hey, I'm in the city. Any chance you're free for a coffee? And I was like, yep. And I hopped on my bike and I went to go meet him over in Tribeca. And the coffee turned into a lunch, and we ended up hanging out for a couple hours, and it was fantastic, man.
When you're playing a real living person and somebody you've actually met, how does that affect your performance?
I think it just puts a lot more pressure on you. I mean, anytime that you're playing someone who is still alive, the pressure is multiplied, you know. And in playing someone who's still alive in such a controversial story in a controversial time in society, I don't think certainly there is more pressures in the world, but as an actor, it's pretty much up there at the top.
So it's a two-part miniseries, pretty genius construction. It's basically before the election and then after the election. Did James Comey participate in the making of this?
From what I understand, yes. I never was able to meet him. I do know that he was on set. Obviously, Billy spoke at length with him about the project. Very interesting, though. I heard Billy Ray, we were doing one of these panels for press, and I heard Billy Ray, they said, so this is based on Comey's book. And he said, yes, certainly. But, I really use that as a jumping off point. Like, one of the great things you can say about Billy Ray is he's one of the hardest workers in our business. And his dedication to research and everything that went into this project was, he said he was, he was on the Hill. He spoke with Republicans and Democrats alike, people from both sides of the aisle. He wanted the full story of what happened. So while, yes, it is based on Comey's book, I think you have a real accurate portrayal of what happened during this time.
I got to tell you how disturbing it was. And so, I mean, I loved it, but just from the perspective of having to relive what I already knew.
Yeah.
It kind of had like a All the President's Men type of feel to it for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why this is so important. And I hope that people see this because, we're living, we're a very divided country right now. And we're inundated with a new crazy every single day, right? Like there's something new look at this crazy thing while I do this over here. And it's just political norms are being broken every single day. And to go back and see how it all started and be reminded of what actually happened, I think, you know, just prior to the election, I think is very important for people to see this on both sides of the aisle.
So do you think, I'll ask you a political question. This is a political project. Do you think Hillary lost the election because of that late announcement about emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop?
The short answer is yes. I do believe that the reopening of the investigation is what ultimately did her in. But you have to realize that she had so many things working against her. And I'm not going to forgive the fact that she didn't go to
Wisconsin.
You know, that's just failure on the campaign's part. But when you have, we know for a fact, all intelligence agencies have said it, we know for a fact that whether it was welcomed by President Trump, he knew about it, I'm not going to debate any of that. We know for a fact that Russia interfered in that election with the sole intent of having him win the election. So that media blitz that they did all over Facebook and everywhere, which is where a lot of Americans, unfortunately, get their quote-unquote news, that played a huge part. But certainly the reopening of the investigation that found nothing 3 days prior to the election, that ultimately, in my opinion, was a nail in the coffin in such a close election.
Do you feel like Comey was, you know, damned if he did, damned if he didn't, because he, you know, was head of the FBI, and if he didn't do what he felt he should do as an FBI, you know, agent, and things did come out and they didn't talk about it and they didn't present it, that he would have been screwed either way?
Without a doubt. I think that this was a lose-lose situation. I think the way that it's addressed in the project is so spot on. It's like, I forget the exact quote because it's so brilliantly written, but it's something like, you know, you have three choices here and they're all bad.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And it's true. But look, James Comey at his heart, you know, you can say showboat, you can say whatever you want to say about him if you have problems with James Comey, but at his heart, as is 99.99% of the FBI, is people with good intentions to serve our country as best they can, right? So yeah. I believe that, you know, he thought he was an apolitical figure in D.C. Everyone thought of him as apolitical, that if he just said this, it would come across as apolitical. And what I don't think that, or certainly in retrospect, what he didn't realize at the time is just how divided we already were. And no matter what you do, and ever since then, no matter what anyone does, it's political. Yeah. It is driven by one party's interest over the other.
So part two of the miniseries, we see Brendan Gleeson as Donald Trump in all his glory. It's a fascinating performance. It captures, I think, the essence of Trump without being a full-on impression. What do you think?
I think, you know, as an actor, Brendan Gleeson is someone I've always admired, right? Like he's always good and most of the time he's great. And I think this performance is certainly falls into the category of the latter. What he did, the way he was able to thread that very fine needle of an impression and being, he just was him, you know, and it's hard because you have a character who is so well known and so often imitated, from late night show hosts to whomever, you know. I thought he killed it. I thought he just killed it. I can't imagine the pressure of taking on that role.
Yeah.
The cadence was so spot on, you know, when he just kind of would like sit back and take his pauses and then those like desperate moments of just relentlessly, you know, needling Comey and calling him up at home and it's all the things that we know that he did, and it really was seamless, I thought.
Yeah, he's something else, and very wisely, from what I understand, is in Ireland and will be in Ireland all through the premiere of this. So good for him to avoid the
Yeah.
the backlash that he might get here.
You know what's interesting, though, is when I was watching it, it felt like, and this will sound weird, it felt like the movie Jaws, because we knew Trump was coming, but there's actually not, there's less Trump in it than you think there is. So there's some mystery behind it. And I just kept thinking, it's the shark from Jaws. He's going to come out any minute now. What do you think?
That's perfectly, I think it's perfect, dude. It's so spot on.
That's so funny.
It really is, though. That's because it's just done and done and done. You know, you're going, right?
yeah. So can we talk about House of Cards?
Sure, man.
So you were part of one of the best TV series of the last decade, House of Cards, and you played Doug Stamper. What I, you know, all the time I'm wondering what is going on inside Doug's head. He's such a fascinating, interesting, twisted character. What was it like to play him?
Oh, man, it was, I've said it before, but it truly was the greatest gift that I could have been given as an actor. Like, that character was so, the way they developed him over the years, you know, it's just a gift, man. I'm eternally grateful to Bo Willimon and David Fincher and Lorraine Mayfield and those guys for giving me that opportunity to give it a shot, you know, and to play that character that is so loved and hated.
You know, there's such a constraint that you had playing him, and I wonder how much of your character was preordained, and I want to know, what was the description of Doug when you auditioned? If you had to audition, I don't know.
I definitely did. As a matter of fact, I auditioned first for Hammerschmidt and the guy who runs the paper, and then I auditioned for Lucas, the one who fell in love with Zoe Barnes and then ultimately was killed. Then I auditioned for the Corey Stoll role.
The congressman.
Yep. And then my callback was with David Fincher, and he said it was for Lucas and, oh, damn, I'm blanking on the Corey Stoll character's name.
Russo, right?
Russo, yeah. And the callback was for that, and he was like, Fincher, it was like a 45-minute work session, and he said, oh, man, I think you can play anybody, man. I want you to read this other guy, though. And I was like, who's left? Because in the pilot that I read, you know, Stamper didn't have a very big part. I was like, who the hell's left?
Yeah.
but you could put it on tape. I'll watch it. I was like, no, I'll do it right now, man. I'll do a cold read. I'm in the room with you, and we're doing a work. I would love to work it out with you. And he's like, don't worry, I'm going to watch it. And anyway, I put it on tape, and then when I got the offer, Bo Willimon called me to congratulate me, and he said, I love what you did in the audition. Everyone loved what you did. And I just sort of kind of, you know, I don't remember there being a description of him like that. I just sort of, it read like that to me. I did sort of, you know, drop my register and my voice a little bit and just sort of deadpanned it. And Bo said, you must have questions. And I was like, yeah, a million, but why don't you start? And he was like, well, basically, I want you to not emote for the first season. And I want, at the end of the first season, I want everyone to say, what the fuck's up with that guy?
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I got it. And those two things really did help me come up with the way he stood. He walked, he talked, he, you know, it just all sort of made sense to me from those little things. And then, of course, you know, with the writers, the way they developed the character after that was, you know, they just kept adding great stuff for me to do. And it was so thrilling and such a challenge. Every year I would say to one of the writers, I just, dude, who would do this? This is crazy. And they're like, I know, but it'll work. And I was like, all right, like, just give it a shot. I'm like, okay.
So was it intimidating being in a room with Dave? I mean, I don't know. When I hear David Fincher, I immediately get sort of intimidated just because I've heard stories. Was it intimidating to be in the room with David Fincher?
Oh, God, yeah, man. I mean, now, you know, I consider Fincher a friend and someone. I still, you know, think the world of the man. He is literally my top two directors on the planet. So he's someone I went into this job just like going, oh my God. And then of course there was, you know, the actors I was surrounded with. I was just like, this is crazy, man. That's my first day of work. I was like, oh God, you know, please don't fire me. It's all you can think is an actor, you know? It's like, but it worked, and we got on really well. You know, one of the challenging things about David Fincher, which I'm sure you've heard from other people, is that how many takes he does.
Yes.
And it's true. And he does a lot of takes. And I'll tell you a good story. One day I had a scene where I was one of those scenes in early seasons where I would just open a door and I'd be like, sir, such and such is here to see you. And I forget who the woman was, but she went in, and I remember it's like a 2-minute scene. So I just went, I would just open the door and then I would go and sit behind the monitor and watch Fincher work. And for the minute and a half scene, and he was like, we're still rolling. And I don't remember her name. We'll say Lisa. Lisa, just breathe. Just breathe. You got this. And then it was just the tension started. You saw the tension just creep into this poor actress who was just dying. And cut to about 2 weeks later, and we're on take 17. And it was a scene where I just had to come in and put my ass on the desk and show Underwood a newspaper article and say, look, blah, 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 explain the. And about take 12 or so, he's just like, Michael, breathe. Just take a deep breath. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. And so I went up to him at lunch and I was like, hey, can I talk to you, boss? And he's like, yeah, sit down. Let's have lunch. And I was like, all right. I said, look, I pride myself on being as prepared as I can possibly be for work and being as relaxed as I can possibly be. And when you said breathe, it was because we were on take 12 or something, and you had said on take 4 to hold the paper at this angle, and then 5 you said this, and then take 7 you said this, and take 9 you said that. And he was like, oh no, man, those are just things I just throw things out just to knock you off your normal groove. And I was like, oh, okay. Maybe you want to tell me that before we start working together. I'm trying to remember every note, you know, that he says, and he's like, still rolling. And you're like, what did he just say 3 takes ago? So it was challenging at first, but I don't mind it, man. And he later explained to me, he was like, you know, the first 7 takes of that were because the background looked like they didn't work there. And it took 7 takes for them to be like, oh my God, whatever. And they would just walk normal. So he has a method to his madness. I don't mean he's mad. I just mean there is a method to what he's doing. You know?
So Robin Wright directed a bunch of episodes. What's it like when you're, you know, when you're playing against somebody, you know, she's a fellow actor and then she sits in the director's chair. What is that like?
I tell you, man, you know, she directed more, ended up directing. It was James Foley for the longest time. And then Robin at the end overtook him for directing the most episodes of that, more episodes of that show than any other director. She is amazing, like a real actor's director. She, you know, I remember a scene with early on, one of her first ones where she was directing me and Rachel Brosnahan. In that scene in the car where I tell her to read to me like my mother used to. It's really weird. And we did a take and Robin was like, cut. And she was like, all right, we're going to go again. And she's screaming because we're in a car and she's way over at Video Village and she's yelling. And then we're like, we can't hear you. And then so then it comes over the walkie in the car and it's still all messed up. We can't hear her. And she was like, and she literally comes running over in her, you know, Levi's and Converse and jumps in the back of the car. And she's like, oh my God, this is so good. Okay, here's what I'm gonna do. And she's just so excited, like a kid, nothing like she is when she's there to play Claire. She's a totally different person when she's directing. And I loved it. I loved her passion. I loved her enthusiasm. I loved her creative input. She is a smart, smart director.
There was obviously a whole bunch of controversy that went on at one point, and there was sort of a waiting period where the show was on hold. What was it like to get back to the set after all that?
It felt so good. I mean, the pressure was just immense after that, obviously, and there were so many hurdles to overcome still. Like, the writers had to write that entire season in a couple months compared to the six or so that they normally take to write one. So there was a lot of that, and sort of like, how are we going to do it? And, you know, writing as they were going along and making the story up as we were going along at times, and all that was there. But I think first and foremost was the love that we all had for one another. That crew was, you know, I call him all the time, my Be More family. And I just texting with a teamster 2 days ago. His Orioles were playing my Atlanta Braves. And I was like, hey, buddy, haven't talked to you in a while. How you been? He's like, oh, I was just thinking about you, man, because I know you guys need to win right now. And we don't. You know, that was one of the teamsters, my buddy Frank, you know. Excuse me. The crafty guys, like, we, the sound guys and I, we were, so many of those people all came over. I produced and starred in a small independent feature that I did called All Square. And we shot it in Baltimore because I knew I could get a lot of the crew to come and work with me. And they did. We were a family. Like, You hear it a lot, but it's, man, we were tight. And so when we all got to come back together after not knowing if we were going to or not, just felt so good. I mean, yes, there was the craziness that was surrounding everything, but at the same time, it was like families back together, man.
What did that role and that character mean to your life and your career?
I mean, just so much. Like, you know, it was after the first season aired that every off season I did a really cool project, and most of them were offers, or at least like have a conversation with a director. And that wasn't happening prior to House of Cards, you know. It was like, you know, call back seven before I would get something, you know. So it completely changed. There were a few moments in my career, and that was certainly the biggest one in the latter, what is right now my latter. I'm not saying I'm done yet, but you know what I mean? Like, it just, it changed my life.
Thankfully, Claire Underwood became president there. Do you think sexism played a role in the last election in 2016?
Oh yeah, of course. Of course. I think that there is, you know, without a doubt, and the irony being, we'd be a lot better off with women running a lot more things.
Hey.
But it's true. Sue, I'm not just saying that because we're two guys and one girl here. Like, I said it then. We, you know, there is a certain, and I say it to my wife all the time, like, she's the rock in this family. She's the one who holds everything together. She's the one who, you know, women are just better at doing more than one thing than men are, in general, I could say.
I think because that's the way, you know, it's been, you know, you're a mom, you're taking care of the house, and you know, it sounds sexist for me to even say that, but, you know, if you just think about all the roles that women have had to do over the years, you know, right. I mean, growing up in my house, you know, like, you know, my father didn't do anything, you know, he didn't even know how to boil water, you know, he never made a meal, he didn't, you know, he worked, and he came home, he had dinner, and watched little TV and went to sleep. That's exactly, you know, that was who he
was. That was my dad, too. That's exactly what he did.
And so they had to fight so much harder to get to where they are. But there's still men, certainly older white men, who just have a problem with it, you know, who are not going to want a female president. They're going to find something wrong with that female candidate. You saw it happen again with, as we were narrowing down the Democratic field. Some women weren't given a shot just because they were women. I believe that. I believe that without a doubt, unfortunately, that is still this country.
Yeah, you said this country when you ended it with that, because you look at other countries and, you know, they are far beyond the United States when it comes to picking their leaders. There are so many women that have been, you know, in charge.
Yeah. And doing great jobs. So,
yeah,
they can do it.
So you live in New York, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you and your family deal with the pandemic?
We were really fortunate. My my brother's father-in-law, a man who I started working for when I was like 14 years old, he had a lake house up in Maine that he wasn't using. They live in Georgia. And so around April, mid-April, we pulled the kids out of school before, a few days before the COVID thing hit. And we were able to go up there. And it was just this little log cabin on a lot of land. And the four of us just had the greatest time from, as much fun as you can have with just the four of you, from April until July. And then we knew how much we loved being on a lake. And so I had a buddy who here in New Jersey who is on a little lake called Greenwood Lake. And I said, "Hey man, you know anybody who happens to be renting their place this summer?" And he was like, "Oh my God, my friends are selling their place and they only want to rent it to a friend of a friend." So it worked out and we got this other little lake house. We went home for like a week and dropped off the winter stuff and got our summer stuff. And we've been here at this lake since July.
Sounds nice, man.
Yeah, really, really. I feel very, very fortunate to have busted my ass doing what I do for a long time to be able to, you know, get through this. A lot of folks aren't getting through this so easily. So I feel extremely grateful.
So is the pandemic affecting you working right now?
Yeah, it is. We would have. Oh gosh, I don't think I can say what I was going to be doing. I can't say. Yeah, I was supposed to be working as of, it wasn't announced that I was doing this job yet, but we were supposed to be working in May.
So that's all held up without any timetable for things picking up. Do you think things are going to start rolling again?
I'm hearing January in another country, but January of 21. So, yeah.
So it's coming.
Yeah, fingers crossed, you know, they stay on course and everything, you know, is okay and we can actually do it and we're allowed to go to other countries at that point. Who knows?
Here's a weird question. So obviously, you know, Comey rule on Showtime is something that is available on cable. We've watched so much streaming programming during this pandemic. Do you think, because you've done movies, do you think movie theaters are going to survive this, or are we moving towards a cable and streaming only world?
I do. I do think movie theaters will survive this, but it's not going to be the same. I think, and this is just my guess. This is not any Hollywood insider talk. I know more about politics and the Atlanta Braves and I do about my industry, but I think it'll survive. It's just going to be different. I think there's gonna be less movie theaters. I think there's gonna be less movies at the movie theaters, but they'll get through it because there's some movies that, you know, you just got to see on the big screen. And so I think they do survive. I just think it's going to be different. I think we were already heading in a direction where more movies were going to be released at home, as it was with Netflix and, you know, and everyone doing Apple doing original content and whatnot. You know, I think we were kind of headed that way to a certain extent.
So what do you think of the Braves?
Nah, man, you know, they're young. I think they're going to make the playoffs. But we'll
see. Acuña Jr. is going to be something, huh?
That kid's special, man. He is special. Like you know, it's a lot of these kids I've been, you know, I know the minor leaguers, like I follow them that hard.
Oh, so you're down deep in the, in the weeds. Good.
I'm from down there and, you know, grew up a fan and, been in New York for 20 something years. But when I moved there, I wasn't just going to jump ship. So yeah. And it's a great way for my brother and my father and I to, you know, we text during every single game.
Wow.
So if one of us isn't able to watch or whatever, we know what's happening. And it's just a fun little thing that I have with my dad and my brother.
Yeah. There's so much sports right now. It's crazy.
My son and my daughter, you know, are 8 and 11 and they love the Braves and my son plays baseball. So, just carrying on the family tradition, you know.
Nice. Nice.
I just have to tell you that the Braves are my nemesis because I'm a diehard Met fan. So
you
have caused us a lot of pain. many years.
I do apologize. And Chipper Jones is no friend of the Mets.
No. Well, I remember the John Rocker days.
Oh, God.
John Rocker. Wow, you're going back.
I would say that's my least favorite Brave of all time.
I would hope so.
I think mine too. well, listen, Michael, congratulations on the Comey rule. Tremendous cast with you and Jeff Daniels, Brendan Gleeson, Jennifer Ely, Holly Hunter, on and on. Can't recommend it more highly. It starts this coming Sunday on Showtime. It'll run Sunday and Monday night. And Michael, thank you so much for doing this. We really do appreciate your time.
Oh, are you kidding me, guys? It's such a pleasure, man. I can't thank you enough for having me.
And there is Michael Kelly. The miniseries is Sunday night. And I kind of broke my own rule about no politics on the show, but it's impossible to talk about a James Comey miniseries without mentioning some kind of politics, right?
Yes. And I'm glad that you did, because it's, you know, that was the nature of it. You know,
the funniest thing is, we know all these names, you know, like it, never before would we have known the Assistant Attorney General, Sally Yates, right? We would never know the acting FBI Director, Andrew McCabe. It's only in this era that we know every single name of every single person that's involved in these controversies.
Well, I mean, I think that when there are controversies like this that are so public, you know, like Watergate, you know, you knew everybody back then.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. You knew everybody.
Iran-Contra scandal, you knew everybody back then.
I'm too young for these, Sue. This is more your era.
I have no comeback to you.
We're not that far apart. I remember those two. I remember.
Yeah. So we're so inundated with it as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's 24 hours a day you're getting hit with it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a crazy, crazy time in the world. It's been a crazy year, and it's going to be an especially outrageously crazy 7 weeks or 6 weeks or however long it is till the election.
Yeah, and the thing, you know, both of these, you know, House of Cards and Comey rule, you know, watching them back to back for me, it made me think, like, how does anybody get involved in politics? It seems like the most horrific job you can possibly have.
It does.
It's like, you know, like you don't trust anybody. Everybody's duplicitous. It's like being in the mob. You know, it's like
it is. You
can't turn your back on anybody. Like who's gonna kill me? Who's gonna attack me? How am I gonna lose my job this time? I mean, it's just so ugly.
Although I will tell you this, Sue, this is a longtime goal of mine. I live in a district where Karen Bass, who you probably know,
was
a candidate for vice president. I intend to, if she gets named to the Senate, and I think she's going to, I intend to run for her seat. What do you think?
Really?
Yes.
Are you joking with me?
No, I'm kind of serious.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you think
I would be?
I think you'd be good.
Yeah.
I think you'd be good. You know, you're on your game when you're into something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you read up and you know.
Study up.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think the people need?
What do the people need? We need to deal with the homelessness crisis. That's going to be my platform, dealing with homelessness. Now, I have no idea how to do it.
Right.
I'm going to get experts and people like that to do it.
And you'll listen to them.
And I'll listen to the experts, exactly. all right, Sue, thank you very much. It's been a great show.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be a part of it.
Thank you very much to Michael Kelly. He was fantastic. And again, the Comey rule starts Sunday night on Showtime. It'll run Sunday night and Monday night. Fantastic show. Definitely you should watch. Thanks a lot for listening to the Culture Pop podcast. Don't forget, subscribe, rate, and review. You can subscribe at stevemason.com. There's an easy button to click to subscribe to iTunes or to Spotify. And Sue, we've got one last thing. You know what it is?
It's Jacob time.
Jacob time. This podcast sponsored by the law offices of Jacob Imrani. Fantastic guy. You know what? He's a huge Lakers fan, Sue.
I know he is. I've seen his posters.
Yeah, I mean, he's at the games. They're actually on the floor in Orlando at the bubble. His logo has been on the floor. I mean, he's really serious. And the reason he's serious is because he's all about winning. He's been winning in this town for over two decades. If you've got a case, any kind of case, injury, accident, car accident, motorcycle accident, you, your wife, your kid, whoever that is, call Jacob. 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. I would trust Jacob with my case. Once he handled a case of my dad's. That's how close I am to Jacob Imrani. 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. Or remember the catchy jingle. Accident.
Injury.
Call Jacob Imrani. Call Jacob. Jacob. It's incredible. You're not getting any better.
And either are you.
Well, I thank you. It's a good note to end the show on. We will see you next time on the Culture Pop Podcast.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.